Okay, in just a moment, up next, our main event, Richard C. Hoagland, Hoagland's year-end disclosure and space review. He's our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, 2010 saw amazing advances in research from a synthetic life form to the first dust returned to Earth from an asteroid. Astronomers reported more than 100 new exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system, bringing the total now to 500. And over the course of the year, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, has been doing his work on disclosure and his own space review. And here's Richard for a full program on Coast to Coast. Happy holidays, my friend. How are you?
Happy New Year, George, and a merry, merry, belated Christmas.
You too. You know, I did my Christmas Eve show, and then I went on my 1 week a year vacation and, you know, spent a lot of time with my kids and did that thing. How about you and Robin? What'd you two do?
We had some friends in for Christmas and, you know, had a nice quiet time. Michael was here, Robin's son, and it's not too much snow. There's a little bit. The mountains look gorgeous. It's a little bit nippy, but it's another New Mexico Christmas.
And I'm finding, Richard, there's nothing wrong with nice, quiet time. It's pretty relaxing, you know?
Well, it's desperately needed when you look at the stuff that you and I look at on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's true. You know, 2010 was an incredible year for science, wasn't it?
It was not only incredible for science, but in terms of the topic we're going to talk about tonight, I have some news for folks. You know, everybody's waiting for disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the show, I want to announce disclosure has occurred. So the next 3 hours will be spent in you pummeling me with questions and me trying to answer to substantiate my statement.
All right. That is fair enough. Now, this is the guy, by the way, that I was first introduced to on television when I watched him with Monuments of Mars back when I think, Richard, what was I, a boy, 5, 6 years old?
Yeah, really, George, come on.
No. Okay, I wasn't that
old. We are essentially contemporaries.
Yes, that is true, all the way, all the way. Now, you know, you quote quite a bit Arthur C. Clarke. You have loved his work, and he coined a phrase at 2010, the year we make contact.
Yep.
And you've used that before because that's part of your mission. How come?
Well, I mean, getting to know Arthur back when I was working at CBS was an amazing, you know, set of circumstances. Because as you just said, I had grown up like we all did, you know, reading him and Isaac Asimov and Fred Pohl and Robert Heinlein. And then one of the really cool things in life is when you get to meet the folks that you have idolized from afar, and they're even more interesting in person, and they take notice of you, and they share things, and you become friends and colleagues. And I mean, that was basically the way it was with me and Arthur. So, yeah, my entire, I guess you could say, to date magnum opus, which is The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, is essentially an ode to Arthur's perspicacity and vision and what he somehow knew that he should not have known. And that comes, you know, through in a lot of his work when you start reading it as not fiction, but as pointers, mileposts, as Rod Serling would say, up ahead, you know, the Twilight Zone. Arthur and all those guys, from my analysis now, having spent a lot of years looking at this, I think these guys were in on it. Whatever you want to call it, I think there was a, what's his name? Alan Hynek and I talked a lot many years ago, and he had a friend named Jacques Vallée who is still, you know, alive and well and
still out there, yeah,
doing very well. Well, Jacques wrote a book called The Invisible College with some, you know, input by Alan Hynek. And I'm beginning to think that there are two tiers of people on this planet, George. People who know what's really going on, who have known our history and where it's taking us, again, because history is, the Mayans were right, it is cyclic. And then everybody else. And everybody else hasn't a clue. Even those that pretend to come on, you know, airtime like this and pretend to know, they really don't, because the actual information has been kept very, very, very and has been entrusted to a very few. And it basically is for the heart and soul and future of humanity, which, of course, without knowing your real history, nobody can do anything in terms of, you know, striking blows for freedom or independence or the persistence of this extraordinary experiment that we're talking from tonight, namely the United States. So I think that Arthur was part of a select group. And the reason I've been taking notice, particularly in the last few months, of what he said, because he's no longer around to tell us, you know, what it meant himself directly, is because I think these guys across decades, from most of the 20th century, I think, were speaking to each other and to their reading public in a kind of code, George.
Yeah, that's possible.
Which is leading to this idea, which is so much bigger than the UFO people have kind of disenfranchised it. The idea of disclosure, as we've talked about before, I think is the big enchilada. Disclosure is everything. Disclosure is who are we? Why are we here? What's our real history? Why are we still Mickey Mousing around with stupid things that can kill us, like fossil fuels and nuclear weapons? And, you know, why do we jump every time someone says boo? I think there was an invisible college, and that some of the not-so-invisible members were writing to us to try to prepare us in some kind of scenario, some kind of set of cautionary tales, what life would be like if we actually someday figured out who the hell we really are and what are we really doing here. And that, to me, is what disclosure is all about. And again, at the risk of making a lot of people very unhappy tonight, because we're not going to get to it right away, I think disclosure came off right on schedule in 2010, and almost nobody has noticed yet.
Interesting. Do you think Spielberg is part of that inside group?
Yep.
Yeah.
And my reasoning is you simply look at his films. I think George Lucas is a star goal-carrying member in good standing. I mean, what is Star Wars? If you back off a few light years and you look at it in perspective, what is Star Wars really?
It's us.
It's us.
Yeah.
It's an alternative history with the human species, our genome, set in a much bigger galactic universe-wide matrix with all kinds of razzmatazz and amazing things and whatever. But the core storyline is about an ancient empire that falls apart and people trying to reconstruct in a quiet backwater of the galaxy. Well, my gosh, Mr. Scott, doesn't that sound a lot like kind of where we are tonight?
Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was based on J. Allen Hynek's book.
Yeah, of course.
And Spielberg.
Remember that great cameo at the end?
Oh, my God, with him holding the pipe?
Super cameo.
Absolutely. See, I'm convinced that there was something afoot then. I mean, there was just too much information in that movie when this was done a long time ago.
Well, remember, I have, along with my colleague on my second major opus on all this called Dark Mission with Mike Vera, Mike and I, for years and years and years, have kicked around the data and discussed all, you know, the everything leading up to this penultimate moment, which is that the lie is different at every level. You have folks that know, and they're not very many, George, I do not believe. Then you have a lot of folks that have been sold all kinds of different stories to basically muddy the trail, to make figuring it out from the outside almost impossible. I mean, what's the best way to keep a secret if you can't keep it with one person? Because, you know, the old joke about, you know, more than two people and one has to be dead to keep the secret. Well, the way you keep it is you make the secret so complex, you create such a surround around the secret that unless you have the code keys or you have some kind of a map or some kind of a cipher, you'll never figure out what the truth is, even if it's right, plain, right there in front of you.
Oh, that is so
because
true.
There'll be and so you... many people telling you, oh, that can't be the truth because that's a lie spread by so-and-so and so-and-so. And what have we seen since 1947 forward? The UFO community is anything but a community. I mean, they eat their young for breakfast, George, on a regular basis.
Oh, you are making fans tonight, Richard.
I'm in my year-end, year-beginning mood tonight.
I might need to get to be your security guard at the next conference you go to. You know, as you just said, the insiders, that there aren't a lot, and I would agree with that. There's probably just, you know, maybe a dozen on this planet that truly have the inside information. I don't know how many, but like you, I don't think there are a lot of people.
Well, I keep looking at the countervailing stories, you know, the pushback here, the leak there, the instant, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, the whole WikiLeaks thing with Julian Assange, I find extraordinarily interesting. Because do you remember what happened in the last few weeks, what was supposed to happen and then what didn't happen, and then what in fact did happen, and then where is Assange on the news today?
Yeah.
Nowhere, right?
Where is he? Yeah.
Yeah, well, what was supposed to happen is all these cables, 250,000 of them, I guess, were leaked to WikiLeaks, which started a publishing process of, what, a few hundred a day or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at that rate, it'll be 2012 before we get to the end of the leak cables. And then in kind of mid-flight, when everybody got really angry at this guy because, oh, my gosh, he's publishing real stuff and it's actually making some people look bad, kind of like the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran. And mm-hmm. I mean, this was a definitely take-no-prisoners list of everybody had a common guy they really didn't like all of a sudden. His name was Julian Assange, right? So they pick him up for this charge in Sweden of sex by surprise. Have you ever heard of something like that?
I've not heard of sex by surprise.
Have you ever experienced?
And I wonder, who's the one who was surprised, him or the...
Exactly. Yes. I could think of a whole bunch of high school stories. Anyway, Back to the Future. The point is that suddenly Assange, in the middle of an interview with The Guardian, as he's being threatened by police action, arrest, et cetera, he says, but I have a thermonuclear weapon. I have cables recording traffic on UFOs.
Yep.
And, of course, it's all nonsense and it's crazy and we don't accept the criteria, you know, unless there's, you know, original sources, et cetera, but I've got these cables on UFOs, and if I'm arrested, I will release them, right?
Yes.
What happened? Assange gets arrested. Sorcha Fowl suddenly comes out with a story that the WikiLeaks UFO cables, in fact, have to do with a celestial war. Does this sound faintly familiar?
Sounds like Ed Grimsley, doesn't
that it? That is going on upstairs in secret, somewhere over the southern areas near the South Pole, near Antarctica. And then after a week, no lesser a light than Michael Moore posts part of his bail, takes on the mantle of WikiLeaks as a subject, says that Assange obviously has to face due process and will clear his name, et cetera, and the entire threat to publish the UFO cables that WikiLeaks garnered through that 250,000 cable data dump just
vanished
away.
Yeah, it vanished. I want to get a hold of, maybe you have, the Dolans, Richard Dolan.
No, I've not talked to Richard on this, but we obviously should.
Yeah.
Because here's my
He'd
analysis.
Hunt this down, wouldn't he?
Huh?
He would try to hunt that down.
Well, I would think so. And I also think that what happened is that the reason that there was a specific leak regarding the UFO context of a war between the United States and somebody upstairs, and then it all went away, is because that was Assange playing his four-card poker game here, where he basically showed one of his cards. And the guys on the inside that really, 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 really know, they knew he was not bluffing. And the deal that got him out and that lets him publish all the other stuff, I guarantee you, if I'm right politically, and it's always a real problem in making bets on politics because they can always change their mind, but I have a feeling that we're not going to see any WikiLeaks cables on UFOs at all, ever.
And that would be very disappointing, because I really thought they had something hot.
Well, but if you follow the game is they basically backed him into a corner. He basically told them, you come one step closer and I drop this bomb. And they made a deal in secret, and he's a free man under house arrest until he goes through the legal process in Sweden, I believe. But nothing in insightful regarding UFOs, ETs, a disclosure, whatever, out of that cable traffic has appeared, or, if I'm right, will appear, because that was the price of his personal freedom. Now, here's where things get interesting and where we can look forward to a really rambunctious 2011. By Michael Moore stepping into this breach, basically backing Assange with his reputation, what he has done is to create a cottage industry, I think, in electronic leaking. And I think that was his intent, because he is backing the idea that you cannot have a free press unless people are free to publish whatever is given them. Right. If they did not incite it to be given. You understand how careful language works there?
Yep.
Kind of like the Pentagon Papers. The New York Times did not go to Ellsberg and say, okay, now look, you break in, get the documents, give them to us, we'll publish them, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
He did that from the inside, looked around for a mainstream news source that would then publish with the integrity of the Gray Lady, and the rest is history.
Exactly.
I think what Moore and others behind the scenes are trying to do is to institutionalize the idea of WikiLeaks, which, as you know, was up for all kinds of really bizarre assaults on the floor of Congress on the part of certain candidates, past and future. People have made some extraordinarily intemperate statements about basically using a gun to solve the WikiLeaks problem as opposed to using the courts. There's a lot of angst on a lot of sides of this, but at the core of it, I think, is a real terror that, in fact, the WikiLeaks idea could take root and multiply. And if I was going to make a prediction tonight, kind of like a belated New Year's prediction.
Well, you're going to make many.
I'm going to make a few. I would say that we've only begun to see the tip of this, chilly iceberg with WikiLeaks. We're going to see a lot more imitators. And some of the stuff is going to be really extraordinary, because once you open that door, once you show that mechanism is possible, then there will be those people who are real patriots, who are on the inside, who are seeing things that they can't abide and have just been missing a reliable mechanism to get it into the public purview. And that's where we're now caught between the old media, you know, the Gray Lady, the New York Times, Washington Post, NBC, et cetera, et cetera. And then the new medium, which, of course, is the WikiLeaks copycats that I think are going to be coming at us with all kinds of intriguing things, including elements of disclosure in the coming year.
And the new media, Richard, it's coming on like gangbusters.
Absolutely.
And it's getting stronger and stronger. It's instant.
Tons of emails, and I'm sure you throw 99% away, because there's nothing, but there's that one little 1% that you cannot not read the stuff you get, which we do too, because there could be something really important. And you and I are also visible, have been ridden this trail for a while. And so people, I'm sure, send you things like they send me things.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, the only things we don't see are the things that go into our spam file, and we get thousands of those a day. I don't know where those things come from.
So do we.
They're just everywhere. But I was perplexed when he came out and said, I've got files on UFOs too. I mean, that seemed to come out of the blue, didn't it?
Well, but he said it in a very bizarre way. Yes, it was like if you or I were in the same situation, and we knew that if we didn't do something, we could disappear and maybe never be seen again.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to play your whole card. You'd have to play the card that they don't want made public.
Yep, go all in and show all your aces.
And that's what he did. And the subject itself has disappeared. Assange has disappeared from mainstream news.
Hold on for a second, Richard. We'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM. And our very special guest as we really start the new year with Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. Richard's also doing a lot of Facebook and Twittering these days. We'll check in with him about that new technology as well, as we do too. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got Richard C. Hoagland joining us. Richard, back to Arthur Clarke's statement about 2010, the year we make contact. What did he mean by the year we make contact?
Well, okay, this is a little bit of a story. So everybody, you know, pull their chairs up closer to the radio, turn the log on the fireplace, because this could take a while. I've known Arthur since 1968, which was the year the 2001 A Space Odyssey premiered. A few weeks later, I was so incredibly fortunate to meet him at CBS News, where he and I had been separately hired to be Walter Cronkite's advisors on how do you go to the moon. I mean, it's not like we've done this before, at least in modern history. So CBS, in their infinite wisdom, you know, wanted to surround Arthur Walter with Arthur. And for some reason, they also hired me. So it was really an amazing adventure for me anyway. Up to and including going to and from the moon. And then some years later, Arthur and I did various projects together. We did a documentary together. I remember us prowling up and down Fifth Avenue trying to go into, they didn't even have Radio Shacks back then. You had to go into a high-end stereo place and try to put together a satellite receiver, which we actually did from off-the-shelf parts that were just beginning. And you should see, I mean, this whole scene appears in one of Arthur's documentaries that was done by a documentarian there in New York, Thomas, I forget the last name. Anyway, they were also involved with the big NASA special Apollo 11 documentary. Anyway, during those years, Arthur and I would talk about a whole bunch of things. And so when the time came for him to consider getting involved with Peter Himes and doing a sequel to 2001, I mean, we all said to ourselves, this can never work. You know, how could you possibly top 2001? So anyway, Arthur, as you know, lived mainly in Shangri-La, a la Sri Lanka. He left the United States, he left England, and he, except for minor trips to and from the Chelsea Hotel down in Lower Manhattan, he basically was a citizen of the world, and he lived most of the time in paradise on the other side of the planet.
He loved it there.
Oh, absolutely. And because he was an avid scuba diver, and you have sparkling seas, and he had a relationship to people that were involved with the tourist industry, and, you know, it was basically write and watch the waves and entertain, you know, people who would come halfway around the world to visit him. I mean, Arthur lived the way civilized people should live. Now, he was the one that told me that any man who commutes more than 30 seconds from office to home is a fool.
So I must be an idiot.
Yeah, because you use L.A. traffic.
Oh, my gosh. I know it.
Anyway, so somewhere along in the early 70s, the idea came up that, well, there might be this sequel, and it was going to be called 2010. And Arthur was going to be in Sri Lanka, and Peter was going to be in Hollywood, and they were going to try to collaborate. And I said, given my, you know, 21st century perspective, guys, I think we can do a little bit better. So I created an internet email system for Arthur and Peter with the help of my friend Ren Brick and the distant help of Jacques Vallée and a company in Silicon Valley who shall remain nameless, who offered the computer services. And Peter and Arthur were able to actually collaborate electronically half a planet away in a matter of hours when it ordinarily would have taken days or weeks to get manuscripts mailed back and forth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if I had any role to play in Arthur's prolific career, the minor role I had was I set him up on the electronic computerized conference so we could actually do the film with Peter Himes.
Right, Al Gore.
Which brings us to the title, because the title of it was always going to be 2010. The subtitle was very much up for grabs. And I remember one time having a conversation with Arthur, to the extent that, well, if you're dealing with when the monolith kind of makes its presence known to contemporary, you know, U.S.-Russian relations, how would you encapsulate that in some way? And Arthur said very simply, elemental. He says, it's the year we make contact. And yet it wasn't contact with aliens or E.T.
Well, how do you define that, then? What is it?
Because in Arthur's vision, now you have to flash back to his first seminal short story. What was the short story that brought Arthur Clarke to worldwide and forever space fame? It was called The Sentinel.
The Sentinel.
And it was about American explorers on the moon in those early years, finding on a peak on the near side of the moon, the side that could see the Earth, a little artifact, an extraterrestrial artifact.
That's right.
Which was surrounded by a ring where no dust had fallen, moon dust, meteors, et cetera, et cetera. The artifact was a tetrahedral pyramid. Can you say tetrahedron? Surrounded by a force field. It basically, in Arthur's purview, in his vision, in the sequence of events that he, in his novelistic side, set in motion as one of the great prognosticators of the future. Remember his book, Profiles of the Future?
Mm-hmm.
Arthur basically said that human beings would come in contact with knowledge of their history, who they were, and who is out there by way of the machine. Not a live being, not an ET, not a multi-tentacled BEM, you know, bug-eyed monster, but a machine.
A rover, something like that.
Well, in the Sentinel, it was a pyramid. It was a tetrahedron set on the moon by someone a long, long time ago from a galaxy far, far away. And when the scientists in Arthur's short story finally were able to crack the force field, the pyramid emitted a tone, a beacon, sent it, you know, at beyond the speed of light, whatever the form of communication was for this super advanced culture, and let the guys who planted the beacon on the moon know that the guys on Earth that they were monitoring had woken up,
yep,
had created technology, had made it to the moon, and had tripped the burglar alarm.
And they're in the club now.
And exactly. Now, that, in order to understand what Arthur meant by this phrase, 2010, the year we make contact, the whole vision of the film, 2010, is the human race makes contact, like Arthur set out in The Sentinel, through 2001, the film and the novel. He sets it out that the first contact we make is by means of an extraterrestrial machine. And I would lay before the House tonight, here at about quarter of the hour, that in fact in 2010, we've had several bites of the apple in terms of Arthur's model that NASA and the White House, and ESA, and even the Russians have given us if we simply open our eyes and understand the criteria for contact.
Explain
it does
that.
Not mean necessarily people, green or otherwise. It means their technology.
Have they found something they haven't told us?
No, they found something and they told everybody. And I told the entire audience here on Coast, and that's one of the things that we're going to take some time later on tonight to talk about, because it's the most astonishing set of dots when you put it together. It's like one of those Rubik cubes where you flip the last piece and suddenly the whole thing makes sense.
And you see it. It's like a puzzle. You
it's
can't
like
see
puzzle.
It until you look at it.
Yeah.
From
now,
above.
We know these people love puzzles. We know whether you're as part of the Invisible College crowd or you're part of the NASA crowd or the Nazi crowd, or the magician crowd, or the Mason crowd, we know these guys eat, live, breathe, sleep, and dream puzzles. They cannot go down the hall without doing it according to 19.5 or 33 or some other of these numbers. So if that's true, if all of these various groups, which have some semblance of the truth about this big, big D word, who are we really? Who is out there? What has happened here before, et cetera, et cetera. If all of these various factions have a piece of the truth, a piece of the action, how do they talk to each other about it without letting everybody else in on the secret? Answer, they use codes. And we've been cracking these codes now in my work. I've been doing it for the last 10, 20 years.
Yes, you have. Then not a lot of people have.
Well, people like Jim Mars have. There's a tiny handful of people who are doing the serious stuff who have understood this now at a gut level.
Would you put Jordan in that category?
Absolutely. Maxwell? Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
All right.
The only problem with Jordan is that Jordan has taken the codes to a certain level, and he doesn't seem to really want to go beyond that level.
He sounds like he's afraid to.
Well, I think he's been intimidated. I think
maybe.
There are people
I think so.
Who have basically done weird things and made it clear
scared
to him.
Him.
But as Art and I used to describe all the time, the easiest way to solve this problem is total disclosure. If you put out there what you've got, then there's nothing they can do because the feathers have already been released from the pillow, quoting my grandmother. You have to put it out there. So tonight at this year-end, year-beginning, I thought we would put a few things out there to let people kind of chew on, to watch the news and watch how events fall over the next few months and maybe up through the end of this year. And I believe you're going to see some remarkable consolidation of the disclosures that have been made in 2010 in 2011.
In 2010, there were a couple bizarre statements, one from the Vatican.
Yep.
One from physicist Stephen Hawking.
You
Vatican, the Vatican talked about baptizing ETs.
Yes, which is theologically impossible.
And Hawking talked about warning us about making contact with ETs because he said, folks, they're far superior to us, and that means that there's a problem. Don't do it. But I found both statements to be strange.
Well, they're not only strange, but they're not random. In other words, if I'm right, and when we were, you know, in the break, I heard one of the promos for, I guess, a former show, and some other guest said that it will never be the president sitting in the Oval Office. It'll be the slow drip, 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 leak, leak, leak that we've been discussing, you and I,
mm-hmm.
for many, many years. And you agreed it was not going to be a major announcement, right?
Correct.
Okay. I don't think it's going to be a major announcement. I think what the announcement will be, if there is one, is a natural form of cleanup to make clear to certain people who have certain information what just went down is not A, but it's B. And for those who don't have the code key, they won't have a clue what's going on. And for those who do, which of course is this audience, they'll be able to look at what the events that transpire and say, oh, so that's what that means. And that connects together with, I mean, think of this. The Roman Catholic Church, of which I used to be a member, and you still are, I believe.
Well, but not active.
Okay. So we both went through that training, and we know how Jesuits think, and we know how sisters function, and we know how, you know, morning mass is said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure do.
Don't you find it as a Catholic, not speaking now as George Norrie, you know, big guy sitting in big chair with big network show, but as a Catholic, did you ever in your wildest dreams think you would hear the statement officially from a representative of the Vatican, ETs are out there, and if we find them, we'll baptize them?
Never, never, never. And I bet Galileo never thought it either.
Exactly. So that right there, for the billion-plus people, I think I've got the number right, who are Catholics on Earth tonight, that right there was a message. The message was, and remember what was also said as part of that conversation, and it actually anticipated the we will baptize them quote by about 6 months.
Well, the other message previous to that was the softening up, and that was a belief in extraterrestrials does not negate your belief of God.
Exactly.
Remember that one?
Yeah. Exactly. And that was by, I think his name is Funeus, Father Funeus.
Yes. And then, you know, we talked to Paula Harris when you set her up for us.
Mm-hmm.
She was interviewing at the time the late Monsignor Balducci.
Yes.
To try to get his comments.
Yeah, who was leaking like a damn colander for years and years and years.
I mean, it was very strange, the whole thing. Anything from the Vatican.
But what else did Funeus say, which is really the key to unraveling the code?
Don't ask me what.
He said, ETs exist, they have to exist, God in his infinite wisdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he said, and we need to consider them our brothers and sisters.
Sounds like they know something, doesn't it?
Well, how do you technically define brothers and sisters?
Technically, we're genetically part of them.
Precisely. We are related. So if you understood from a theological perspective that you can't go around, even if you're the Pope, baptizing ETs willy-nilly, because under the, and there's a very long theological discussion that you should probably have with Joseph Farrell about this, it really is not only not possible, but I think in some of the finer nuances, it would be kind of going against God's law if you were to baptize ETs and they were not the right ETs. And how do I define the right ETs? Well, you go back to Genesis, you go back to the sons of Adam, you go back to the concept of original sin, which is why you need to baptize a human being anyway. To remove the scourge of original sin. In other words, what the church is really telling us, and I'm going to get to Hawking in a second, is not only do ETs exist, but they are baptizable, which means they're not really aliens. The church is telling us in code, and it did this in a big way in 2010, that ETs exist, A, B, they can be baptized, and C, if they're baptizable, they are part of the human family, they're part of the fallen sons of Adam, which means the extraterrestrials that Hawking was warning us about right out of the big screen cinemascope effects of Independence Day, you know, White House and Times Square blown away, is that the ETs we might meet might be as rapacious as the worst gang lords or the worst pirates or the worst robber barons of the earth, and therefore we should give them a wide berth.
He could be right.
But if he's dealing with the same information that the Pope is dealing with, then they're talking about the same ETs who you can baptize, which means they're human. And that gets us into this extraordinary never-never land of secret space programs, developments after the war, after World War II, extraordinary technological and physics breakthroughs, things that have been sequestered into deep, dark, never, never to see the light of day land, certainly for people like you and me and the folks that are listening to us tonight. And that, of course, brings us back to Julian Assange. Because if there is, in fact, data, some references to UFOs and extraterrestrials and a shoot 'em up war and whatever is in that cable traffic that Assange and friends are alluding to, my feeling is the reason that he made disparaging remarks about UFOs, George, is because in the cable traffic, they're not UFOs, they're IFOs, and they're part of the secret human space program that you and I have been discussing for year after year after year. And we had two huge leaks reinforcing that model by extraordinary authorities.
Well, we're going to get into all of that in just a moment.